Hello listeners, so first thing to say before we get into this is that I've developed a bit of a killer hangover since recording the actual podcast, so the intro might not be quite as exciting as the podcast itself. We've got PSG pro player Phil and Fed's Luke on the show to chat about their time at what was a fascinating FIFA tournament in Manchester, plus Foot Tactician is on to run the rule over the pros' tactics. I'm your host Ben, and while I head off to fry some bacon, I'll leave you with this week's installment of the Foot Weekly podcast on Foothead and all your podcast providers. Hello and welcome to week 31 of the Foot Weekly podcast. Yes, we weren't here last week, but we're back with a vengeance because we've had a very big, significant event in Manchester. And first of all, I just want to say if any of you can hear strange noises in the background, it's because it's actually really hot in the UK at the moment, which is something we don't get to say very often. But it does mean that if you can hear fan noises or doors opening and closing or the outside world, it's because all the doors and windows open. And it's probably the same for Steve. I don't know how it is. Where are you on the east coast of?
Yeah, the east northish, and it's even reached up here, Ben. Yeah, it's warm. I'm sort of semi outdoors, yeah. So all good.
That was the sound of Steve, aka Foot Tactician, who's joining us this week. And once again, we're going to get into the tactics of Manchester, and we've also got a man who was there playing at Manchester. It's PSG's Fiddle. Fiddle, how are you?
I'm doing all right. The weather's not as nice as it seems over there. It's rainy, boring. About the weather I expect here in April.
Nice. And where are you? You're like Cincinnati or something?
Yeah, Cincinnati, Ohio, United States.
And a man who should be used to pretty hot weather, we have Luke Zimmerman, aka, well, your Foothead's, I guess, head of news, head of most things, actually. How are you, Luke?
I'm doing pretty well. It was about the same temperature here in Texas yesterday as it is today in London, so that tells you how hot it is in London, but a little humble brag, it's nice and sunny and 60 degrees today, so I think I'm probably winning the climate battle amongst the four of us.
Yeah. It's all about the contrast, really, isn't it? It's basically like a tropical holiday here. So it was, and it actually wasn't great weather over the weekend when you guys were over in the UK. And actually, we should probably start with that, not the weather, of course, but the actual tournament. Luke, you came back to me with some feedback from Barcelona, and it wasn't particularly positive. These were obviously big, significant events, part of the FIFA competitive calendar. And it's fair to say there were quite a few complaints after Barcelona.
Yeah, I mean, I come from a traditional sports background, having covered American football in the US before covering FIFA, and it's certainly from a press perspective wasn't the worst sporting event of any kind that I've ever been to, but I think for the actual athletes themselves that were competing in Barcelona, there was a lot of making it up as they went and not in a good way. So there was tons of delays, tons of logistical problems, catering was an issue, they had limited, you know, some players have dietary restrictions or maybe even religious based requirements for what they eat and don't eat, and that wasn't always adhered to. So there was just a lot of frustration, both in terms of, you know, actually executing things on time, in terms of keeping everyone fed, happy. You know, the days were really, really long. You know, it's already for covering these events, you know, you're standing 10, 11 hours. But what I think gets overlooked is how mentally and physically grueling it is for the players themselves, because they're, you know, competing in these like really high stress, high mentally exhausting kind of games, almost like a chess tournament or something. And these are really long days over an entire weekend. So if you're, you know, both miserable in terms of how long you're waiting for your games, how the games go, there were technical issues. Some were EA's fault, some weren't, but I think there were a lot of lessons to learn. The good news is that the Manchester tournament, they really took that feedback and kind of turned it into a net positive. I was speaking with the representative from Microsoft at the wrap party after Sunday's final day, after the grand final, where MS Dosari won, kind of making it another title for Xbox, which I guess we can hit on later. Why does Xbox always win? We'll pick Fiddle's brain on that. But you know, the guy from Xbox said that this was one of the best esports, not even just FIFA, but esports events he'd been to, period, in terms of logistics, in terms of execution, just everything from top to bottom, the little details, the attention to detail was just completely night and day. So I think not only was the event more positive for everyone in attendance, be it the players, the media, the coaches, there were some tweaks, I think, behind the scenes for media and coaches, very first world problems that I can maybe speak to a little bit. But I think overall, it was just so good. I think the quality really shown on the stream and in the broadcast, just in terms of the gameplay, I think was so much better because there weren't all these delays, there weren't all these technical issues. I don't know if EA made any changes in the code or anything like that to prevent what happened. I think in Barcelona, especially on the final day, is they couldn't even play PlayStation games, and this happened on Friday too, the first day, due to technical issues with the PlayStation network. EA doesn't, you know, the games are LAN games, but they use the PlayStation network and Microsoft's Xbox network for kind of handshaking to kind of validate the games. I don't know if they disabled enable that in their esports build of FIFA or what, but there were no hiccups whatsoever. Everything was, I don't know that there was maybe a single issue all weekend front facing. I'm sure there was some stuff behind the scenes that everyone can talk about. You know, Fiddle has some probably from his vantage. I know a couple on my end that I heard other media people complaining about, but I'd say overall it went from, you know, a C minus D to probably an A minus A, which I think is a huge, huge jump.
Fiddle, what was your perspective as a player? Did you feel that things were greatly improved? I know you were at both events, so I guess you're a good person to ask.
Barcelona, like, I mean, Luke pretty much hit everything. It was a mess from the get-go. They just, I think when they were introducing the new format for everything, it was something they didn't really account for. They tried to get us to play too many rounds in too little time. So when one delay set everything back. But taking that into Manchester, I felt like they had something to prove because, I mean, surely they got a lot of negative feedback, no positive feedback from Barcelona. The only positive thing they could bring from that was DH Texas story because that really helped them out, brought some new fans into the scene. But they took all that negative feedback and they really showed that they were being serious about this with Manchester. From when the second we got there, they brought us to the venue a day early to make sure we didn't have any issues. There was none. Mm-hmm. We got 2 hours of friendlies in. We went back, came back the next day. Everything was absolutely perfect. Like, from a player standpoint, the only standpoint, I think, were that people were upset were, like, the coaches and the managers because they weren't allowed behind their players. They were able to watch from a viewing area, but they couldn't, like, help out their players like how you were able to in Barcelona.
Hmm. Do you know why that was? Why there was that change?
I believe the change was made. We weren't directly told, but I think the change was made to maybe to cut down on the delays that they were having in Barcelona because it was so crowded and finding a player was impossible. So if you kept all the players designated in an area, it was easy to find them, easy to get them to their station and start all your games on time.
Part of what I think I heard, you know, this isn't like word of mouth or anything, but just sort of my inference on kind of some of the pros that I had talked to, because I think that was maybe the one negative is that I heard some media folks complaining because we were literally behind the action, you know, could film over people's shoulders. You know, if there was a crazy DH Tech El Tornado, we could shoot that, you know, upload it directly to social. That's obviously a big win for the Bleacher Reports, Uni Lads, Footheads of the world. We couldn't do that anymore because we were sequestered to the same area as the coaches. We had a little bit of a press room kind of back to ourselves, but there wasn't even TV viewing area in there, so it wasn't like a huge advantage or anything. But other than those complaints, those were the only complaints I heard too. But I think it makes some sense because what I had kind of picked up on is that especially in some cases where you had these free agents that didn't have teams, or you had guys that were maybe the lone player for their org, they'd have these coaches with big entourages behind them. And in some of the weird cases, these are definitely edge cases, but you could end up in a match right next to your opponent physically, and if you had no one behind you, or maybe you just had one coach who was quiet and kind of more giving you, you know, feedback during breaks, but they had 10 people who were screaming in a foreign language, you know, angrily. That could be, you know, distracting. It could impact your gameplay. It could change maybe how you emotionally process it. I mean, maybe, you know, there's a case to be made that these, you know, athletes, especially with their noise canceling headsets and stuff like that, should be able to just, you know, filter out the noise and kind of deal with the environment as it comes. But I think that proved to be a problem for some. And just to kind of, in the interest of fairness, kind of restrict those feedbacks to in between matches or after matches was probably in EA's mind a little bit more than the professional. I don't know if Fiddle can probably speak a little bit better to that, if that bothered him or not. But
I think that as a coach, you'd like to have a presence with your player, but whether or not that has to be an actual physical presence is another matter, really, isn't it? I mean, you could, as you're alluding to, the players are wearing headsets. Why can't they just get coaching via the headset, you know?
Well, during the matches, like kind of from the knockouts on, where you're sort of on a big stage and then you have the crowd behind you, there's actually more direct access for the coaches there, which is kind of an interesting dynamic. Like, especially some of these German guys, they were yelling tactics and instructions and stuff like that, like mid-match.
Another issue that I've heard pros mention about the tournament was I wasn't able to make it there, so I don't know about this. You other guys will. Apparently, there were giveaways during half-time in some of the big matches in the console finals and what have you, and apparently that was quite distracting.
Yeah, I'm curious as to Fiddle's thoughts on that. It was just during the grand final. I think this was really not, forget about, I mean, the giveaways, I guess, could theoretically be distracting to some players who were really dialed in. The pacing was just very different in the grand final itself, the cross-console final between MS Tessari and Eins Vogel. They actually, after each half, had pauses. And I think it was just to pay the bills to have ads on the stream. That's my guess. To kind of fill the null, I guess, the void for people that are in attendance, they were doing like shirt giveaways, FUD item giveaways, and stuff like that, which I guess some pros were complaining about and coaches were complaining about. I don't know. I mean, I think in the Super Bowl, the Champions League final, you have these big long half times and big long commercial breaks. So maybe you just have to roll with the punches. I don't know. As a pro, would that take you off your game, Fiddle, or what do you think about those?
I think it probably wasn't needed, but I mean, if they needed to do that, then what makes it fair to me is both players are doing it. Like, that's why whenever there's like bad conditions, like some can adapt better than the other, but I mean, these long half times, I don't think it's that big of a deal. Like, I would rather it not be a thing, but with it being a thing, I just don't think it affected that much.
Yeah, I wonder how much those kind of things affect pros. And one of the things that I wanted to talk about was the gameplay itself. A lot of people say that the gameplay does feel different to playing in the weekend league. Fiddle, is that something that you've experienced over the two tournaments you've played? Because that seems like quite strange, considering Foot Champions is the mode that qualifies you for the event. For you then to go to a tournament and have different gameplay, or feel that there's different gameplay, it would seem somewhat strange.
Gameplay wise, I mean, like, honestly, when I play FIFA, I feel like there's like seven different gameplays. There's like Foot Champions gameplay, there's draft gameplay, there's online friendlies gameplay, but all of those have no correlation to how it feels at an event. I don't think it's bad. I think the event, like, gameplay, if we could get used to it and actually practice for it, it would be perfect. Like, it would be a perfect game. But with it being only available at EA events and your three friendlies before you play is the only preparation you get, it makes for a kind of interesting thing, because if a player adapts quicker, then they're in a huge advantage. But gameplay wise, I can't even put, like, I can't even pinpoint what feels different about it. I feel your AI doesn't help you as much, and it's so different. Like, there's not even a certain style that works. Like, some will be like the 4-2-3-1 is the better formation, but that's not the case. When you get to like the finals, you'll see 4-3-3s, you'll see 4-4-2s, you'll see 4-2-3-1s, you'll see 4-1-2-1-2s. It's all these different styles, so it's not like one formation works best on it. So it's just kind of interesting.
I'll tell you something that I noticed, and you'll be able to speak to this because you played Guerrilla. I noticed that players who were taking a more direct approach, who were looking to get the ball forward quickly and maybe hit on the counter-attack, I noticed that they were the players who seemed to be struggling the most, really. The players with the more patient, you know, possession build-up style didn't seem to have such a problem, but people who were just lumping the ball up there, they seem to be the ones that suffered. Would you say that was true in your game with Guerrilla?
With Guerrilla, I mean, me and Guerrilla kind of play like similar styles, in the sense that I pretty much play around like the same way he does it better. But like, see, you think that the players that play quick aren't at an advantage, but someone like Nicolas Rosek, Barcelona and Manchester, plays 4-1-2-1-2, he'll go right at you, quick passes, 1-2 passes right through you, and he seems to make it work. He's lost in the console final both times. Like, that's the most consistent performer that's been in the scene this year. So, I mean, it's weird. Like, it seems that different styles work. No one can kind of pinpoint what's the best.
Theoretically, that should be the case, right? That different styles should work, because it does in real football. Sorry, going back to the point about gameplay being slightly different, could that not be because you're playing, you know, other pro players? And in a weekend league, yeah, you'll play top players. But, you know, when you play those top players, my assumption it is you're being connected with players who are probably a less solid connection to you than when you're playing your kind of average player that you play over the weekend league. As soon as you go into the big tournaments, you're obviously playing on theoretically a perfect connection. I don't know, my theory is that presumably the gameplay actually is the same Foot Champions and LAN events, but because LAN is connected more consistently and properly, it means that the gameplay is going to feel slightly different. And actually, how many games do you play in a weekend league where you're playing other really, really top pros? Do you think that might actually be the cause for people saying this?
Foot Champions, I don't really like compare Foot Champions and an event, because you really don't match. You match 5 good players, I'd say 5 to 10 good players, and then you match 25 dudes that are playing Weekend League just for fun, trying to get their gold 3 or whatever it is they feel they should be getting. But I like to compare it to online friendlies whenever we're like playing. I'm playing against my other pro friends, the Joey, IX Joey, Alexander, all my pro friends that I scrimmage with, and it still feels different from that. There's just like something different about it.
Oh, so that connection, playing like friendlies, not competitively, that's all done peer-to-peer, isn't it? So it's not through the servers, whereas FootChamps is through the servers.
Yeah, so think about like online, you've got, from a technical standpoint, in a friendly even, you still have your console, your router, your ISP, some sort of central, regional, or node. And in some cases, even when you're playing these guys, these are players that are states away. So it'd be like countries away in the EU. So you have all that going on. LAN is obviously direct. I personally, from a technical standpoint, think that the feel is probably just the LAN connection. But yeah, it sucks that there's not really a way to simulate that. I don't know technically how much of a challenge that is for EA engineers. That I think is the hardest thing. Because I take EA at face value that like the game is not the same, or the game is not different, right? The code's not different. They don't have the time and resources to build a separate version just to spite the pros, which some pros seem to think that that's the case. Like, why can't we play the same version? It's just the connection makes it feel so different. And then I think there may be a little bit to the talent differential. But yeah, I mean, like you said, you're scrimmaging your peers that are fellow pros, and it still feels different. It's frustrating, I'm sure. Like, you can't really prepare for that. There's no way, like, you guys can't book a flight to Kansas City or to Ohio and just like do it up in person. That'd be like the best way to prep, but it's just not practical.
I do have something on that point with but even if we were to go and say I have a player, a friend, Joey, he lives in Michigan. If I were to go out to Michigan and play him, we still can't use. There's two versions of FIFA 18. I don't know what the difference is. There's FIFA 18, and then when we go to an event, an EA event, it's FIFA 18 Esports Edition.
There's not actually any difference in the gameplay. The only difference is that ability to do the aggregate scoring. That's like the only thing they coded differently. Yeah. It's possible, since Barcelona, that was the case at Barcelona. That's what I heard from an EA, you know, I don't want to call them representative because they weren't licensed to speak. Let's call them a source, right? It's possible they made some changes between Barcelona and Manchester, but I doubt it because they're busy working on other things. They might have changed it, like I alluded to earlier, to where you no longer have to have the handshake with PSN or Microsoft to prevent those technical issues. But the game, at least, like once you start the game, it's the same. There's not any code difference. So I think it's got to be connection, personally. But
there are a lot of myths around there being different types of games, like people saying that there are different modes, have different gameplay and all that kind of stuff. But actually, a lot of it just comes down to other factors, like, for example, chemistry making Ultimate Team feel different. And you can go back to our producer interview, which we did at the very start of this year, and there is no difference between all the gameplay is the same in terms of the code in all the different modes. It's just obviously chemistry affects foot. So
the fact that they have that like interstitial loading screen that says Esports Edition, though, that like makes you subconsciously question it, whether or not there is any difference. Yeah. Like, why did they even do that?
It's weird because we can't even. I also qualify for ESWC Sao Paulo in Paris. And neither of those events, they have EA qualifiers. Like, if you win them, you can make the EA playoff in June. But we still, like, we get loaded accounts, you know, like, where you have availability to use any player in the game. But they still don't allow us to use the Esports Edition. It's just weird. I don't understand why it's only at those cups Esports Edition.
I'm sure that 50% of the listeners would like to know if scripting is a thing at FIFA tournaments. Was there some kind of EA conspiracy to ensure that MS Dasari won it? Because Saudi Arabia is obviously cash rich, so people from Saudi could get interested in the game and buy more packs. Is that a thing?
No, I don't believe any of that. I've heard some crazy things about DH Tech's story as well, that they bumped DH Tech's sliders up. I just think if it's your day, it's your day. There might be some FIFA gods, but...
What was the thing people were saying? Remy Martin was using DH Tech's account? Was that the rumor at Manchester?
Yeah, we had a little thing. It was a little weird. I was sat next to Tech's for the event throughout the whole weekend, throughout the group stage and whatnot. And he was given the same exact account from Barcelona. And the three people next to me, we all got different accounts. So it was really weird. But, I mean, it didn't turn out to go as well for him this time. But I don't know. I don't think there's anything like that.
And
I was being lighthearted, really.
And a little bit of an aside, I'm actually curious about this. In every, at least in Manchester, and I think it goes back to Barcelona as well, I'd have to look back at the records. We haven't really seen what we saw in the MLS Cup, where there's one player that just kind of runs the table all day. I think both finalists in Manchester, definitely. I think both finalists in Barcelona, the finalists in Barcelona, for those of you that didn't follow it, were Nicholas 99 FC, who went undefeated until, I think, either the quarters or console semis in Manchester. He was one of the finalists against DH Tex. Both him and Tex, and then at this final, Einsvogel and MS Dosari on the Xbox side, all went 5-2. Do you think, Fiddle, that losing games early kind of gives you more information, kind of gives you kind of more room for self-analysis that maybe if you just run the table, you wouldn't necessarily have to make? Do you think that's an advantage, actually, to lose in the group stage?
I think it's interesting that every finalist has been 5-2. That's a really interesting stat. I mean, it's all just down to, like, once you get into the top 32, top 16, there's such a minimal difference between the players. It's just a certain little bounce can be the difference in a game. So I don't think it's it helps you to lose, but...
You lost a couple early, didn't you, Fiddle?
I've lost... I think I went 3-4 this past event. Barcelona went 4-3.
All right.
I mean, the margins between that one match have to be razor thin, too.
Yes.
Like, that's wild.
It's pretty amazing, you know, how tight the margins are in the games. I mean, I don't know, that there's something quite fascinating about seeing the matchups in that sense, because you never really know who's going to come out on top. But it's not because the randomness of the game, it is because the two players always end up being really well matched when you get into the final. And even in games where you see one team do really well and pull away, you often actually do get the other player come back into the game, and you can see those momentum shifts, which, you know, obviously I know that's a dirty word, but you genuinely do see the psychological shift in the players as they start to score goals and they pick up, you know, more momentum and start to do better in the game. And Fiddly, is that something that you kind of see yourself when you're playing?
I think the momentum thing, it's not like a thing in the game actually itself, but players, athletes in real life, athletes in esports, anything, they feed off momentum, and some do it better. Like a game of basketball, it's runs, 10 points, 10 points. FIFA, you get one thing go your way, and then you just start, like, you start an attack, and it puts the other guy on the back foot. It's hard to stop it, no matter what it is.
Going back to your point, Ben, I think something that I find quite often is that when you get to the higher levels, where there is such a narrowed skill gap, a lot of it, as you correctly allude to, does come down to mental abilities. And quite often, it's the player who's prepared to be the most cynical, who's prepared to close a game off and make sure that his opponent has no way of coming back. They're the ones that tend to be the most successful.
But also, on the other hand, do you think it's also players who can play with that kind of freedom and feel kind of loosened up by the whole thing? Underdog, just happy to be there. There isn't the same kind of pressure that someone like Guerrilla has, or even maybe, you know, Fiddle yourself, being a PSG player.
Myself, I feel a little bit. I feel that any player at a top org or club or whatever it may be, it's always in the back of your head. You have a little bit of an expectation, and you know if you don't get to this, say, a certain point, you feel you've let yourself down. You feel like you've let a few people down. But while you're playing, you don't really feel it. Well, myself, I'm just focused on that game and what I can do to win that single game.
Of course. And so, Fiddle, talk us a bit about kind of what you used at the event. What tactics you went for? Is that something you were doing throughout Foot Champions, the tactics you used? Or do you bring a different loadout almost into the big tournaments?
Interesting enough, I made a big mistake with this last event, because talking to, like, I do something online, it works. I do something at an event, it doesn't work. But at Barcelona, I was running my normal 4-1-2-1-2 narrow, going, just playing my way, and I did well. I had tough matchups. I still got out of my group, which I was proud to do. And then I went through a little bit of a dark, I would say, time on my online FIFA, and I was starting to lose games I shouldn't, getting out the results I wanted. So I switched to the 4-4-2, which seems to be a popular formation, and I tried it to bring it into Manchester, and I underperformed like no other. Like myself, I knew at the end of the weekend I could have done better. I shouldn't have made this change, but I mean, you can only learn from things. If you lose, you got to learn. So,
and what would you have gone for in hindsight if you could have changed that?
If I could go back, I would just stick. I would have practiced my 4-1-2-1-2 all the month upcoming to the event, and I would have used that there rather than the 4-4-2.
Mm-hmm. And you don't mind the kind of narrowness of that formation? It doesn't concern you in terms of attacking options or anything?
I think you can make your own space in it. Like the outside backs, I still leave my outside backs on stay back while attacking, like everyone should. But I mean, you can still get them involved if you build it up slow throughout the back, and then once you get everyone up the field, you can start to, I would say, blitz the opponent because you have so many people in the attack.
Something that I noticed, Fiddle, from watching MS Dasari was he, I think it was the, it was either the grand final or the one of the finals. He was playing the poor 1-2-1-2 narrow for a time, and he had his fullbacks on stay back while attacking. But all the time, he was triggering runs with them. He was getting them involved in 1-2s, and he was getting some great width that way. So he still had the defensive solidity, if you like. You know, if a counter attack came, he always had one fullback back, but the other one was always there providing width and what have you. I don't know if that's something that you do, or whether you tend to get your width from just kind of shuttle runs from the center mids.
Yeah, it's mostly just like if you build up too fast, your outside backs don't get involved. But if you kind of keep it like, say, I'm gonna pass from your defensive mid to your center mid to your outside back, you can get them involved that way. If you want a tactically brilliant player to watch, it was MS Dasari throughout that whole weekend, using like 5 different formations.
Yeah,
and, like for different situations, it was awesome to see.
I was literally just going to say that he changed, I think, in the console final against Rasic, who you mentioned. For me, not taking anything away from MS Dasari, who was a totally worthy champion. He's won big FIFA majors before that EA has run. But Rasic was the best player of the whole tournament for me. I think Dasari was probably right after him. But in that match, he changed formations and tactics like 6 or 7 different times. It was insane. Like, I might change at the 68th minute or whatever, almost formulaically in my, you know, not that I'm playing like serious pros or anything like that. Against like a player of equal ability to myself, like gold one, maybe caliber, that's what I'll do. I'll change like once just to try and catch my opponent off guard, maybe twice at absolute most. He was changing 2 or 3 times and a half, which is that, do you think that's overkill, Fiddle, or do you think that that's just the situation was dictating that for him?
It depends. And if he feels that was way, I definitely won't question anything he did, because he took someone like Rasek, who was scoring, I think at one point he was scoring 7.7 goals a series. 2 games scoring 7.7 goals, and he was shutting them down, and a few lucky bounces at the end that could have gone either way, but I mean, he played it brilliantly. Whole tournament.
Do you guys think that... sorry, Ben, I'm kind of treading on your toes here. Me and Luke are asking questions away and sort of like...
No, that's what it's all about. Get the discussion going.
Do you think that this is... It could be significant in terms of... Do you think this will encourage pros to take tactics more seriously? Because... even if it's a 5% advantage at that level, that's a massive advantage, a massive edge to have. So do you think this will lead to pros being a bit more savvy about things and paying a bit more attention and, you know, being prepared to learn 2 or 3 different formations, Fiddle?
For my case, it did exactly that. Like, I came home and I started playing games, and I already said throughout the next few months before my next events and whatnot, I want to have 4 or 5 formations that I know I can switch to and be confident with. Because, I mean, if he doesn't make all those changes, I don't know. I just feel Rasek, because I think the difference in the game was that first 15 minutes when Dasari would switch formations, that Rasek felt, oh gosh, this is a new look. And then Dasari would grab a goal, and then Rasek would start to bring it back. He would learn what he's doing, and then MS Dasari would make another change, and it was just right back to that, and he had the advantage.
Yep, so he had the advantage by being reactive, which was a bit odd. Normally you get the advantage by being proactive and taking the lead, but he actually managed to get the advantage just from reacting to what his opponent was doing, which I thought was absolutely amazing. It was brilliant.
And one of the points on this that I'd make is I was always amazed, because I watched quite a bit of Barcelona actually, and was amazed by the lack of flexibility that a lot of players had. You know, they wouldn't necessarily change formation that much. When they did, it was arguably too late. They were reluctant to switch to anything beyond 4-2-3-1. Or the 4-1-2-1-2. And it really surprised me, because FIFA, one of the big kind of problems almost with the game is that the players on the pitch can't react to changes in formation very well. Like, they don't position themselves that cleverly in response to another formation. Because in real life, obviously, if a team's playing a formation, there's a lot more nuance to the way it will play. Like, whereas you don't really get that so much with, you know, players don't have that kind of intelligence to do that within FIFA. So if you can pick a formation which counteracts your opponent very well, then actually the AI is going to really struggle to do anything about that. I mean, Steve, you know very well, because you've got those 3-4-3 guides, that formation particularly, if you come up against the narrow formation, is really successful.
Oh yeah.
And you just didn't see people doing that so much.
No, I mean I agree with what you say. There's obviously only so much that you can do in terms of instructing your players to do this, that and the other, and it's probably a frustration that's shared by managers in real life, I'd imagine. As soon as players cross the white line, you know, they become a law unto themselves in a lot of cases. I do think that you can exercise a lot of control, though. One of the reasons that we pay so many coins for these players is because of the stats that they have, isn't it? And one of the stats that's valuable, especially in terms of attacking, is attack positioning. I wouldn't underestimate the potential of players using the artificial intelligence to find the pockets of space and what have you. But, yeah, in a way, I mean, I guess that EA, they have to strike a balance between it being a game that you play rather than a game where you're a manager, if you see what I mean. So probably a tricky balance to strike, I'd guess.
I want to jump in and ask Fiddle real quickly. So a regular around these parts and a Futhead contributor, Fud Economist, he had a tweet the other day that the responses were all just ridiculous and terrible because that's how Twitter is. But it was still an interesting question. He asked, FIFA 18 is what percent tactics, what percent skill, what percent team, and what percent luck? What would your answer to that be?
So team, skill, luck,
tactics.
All right, so I would put it on. Team is about 40%. Luck, I think, is only about 10% of it. And then what were the other two? Tactics and skill?
Yeah.
I put 15% tactics and the rest on skill.
What would you have put tactics on before you watched MS-DOSery this weekend?
Probably even less, 5 to 10.
Right, yeah.
It's pretty fascinating. I think something else tactically I saw this weekend was Guerrilla was kind of, he lost his first match. He was struggling a little earlier, and he switched to a 3 at the back, which, you know, I know Steve has talked about kind of on, you know, some of his work and podcasts in the past, getting luck out of, but I can't defend to save my life with it. Could you imagine a world where, like, a pro does really, really well, gets deep into the knockouts with a 3 at the back Fiddle, or is that just, like, a pipe dream?
I think Guerrilla, I honestly, I'm in no place to critique him because he's done a lot more and will do a lot more than I'll ever do, most likely. But I think him making the 3-5-2, it helped him get to a certain point, but I don't think he ever had a chance in that tournament to win it with a 3-5-2. I think once he went away with what he does best, and I just don't think it was a smart decision by him, and he ended up losing to one of my Canadian friends, Goal Machine, who had an insane tournament, running a formation you never see, 4-3-2-1.
I really enjoyed watching Goal Machine. I thought he was great.
And was he playing a 4-3-2-1, did you say?
Yeah, 4-3-2-1.
Yeah, it's really fascinating, isn't it? I mean, that formation particularly is, I've always thought, one of the big no-nos of this year, because the midfield often goes missing and you don't really have much cover in the centre. And then the three, I didn't ever feel like the left forward, right forward and the striker ever really had the kind of nous to make the right runs, even when I changed to different custom tactics. I might be completely wrong. I don't know. Fiddle, have you tried that yourself?
4-3-2-1, it's not something that's worked for me, but the reason it works for him and why he did so well, you've never seen anything like it, the way he played it. The way he played it, the players he had Bergkamp at left center mid. You know how you usually have your right-footed Ronaldo at right forward, you would think, and your left-footed Messi at left forward. No, he did it backwards. He'd put right-footed Ronaldo at left forward and left-footed Messi at right forward. So, I mean, it was just something so new. So whenever he was coming out and playing these guys like Megabit, Guerrilla, who have been playing all these years and all these events against the same thing, and whenever they played against him, it was something completely new, and they did not expect it.
Did you catch any of that, Steve?
The conversation or the play?
Well, I'd hope you catch the conversation.
Sorry.
The play itself.
Yeah, I did. I watched quite a few of Goal Machine's games, and it was interesting to see the way that he played it, that he brought new things to the table, and totally agree with Fiddle. I think he caught a lot of people off guard by doing that. And it shows as well that you don't necessarily have to make massive changes to get the upper hand. Sometimes it can be just the odd little wrinkle, like playing a player on the opposite side to where he normally would be and having him cut in and getting shots in, that can make the world of difference.
So I was going to say, Steve, actually, one of the things that was really interesting about what Dosari did in the final was switching to the false nine formation, which is not really something you see very often. What was he kind of trying to do with that, did you think? Was it just trying to keep the ball, basically? Or?
I think it was mainly about possession. The false nine is useful in terms of dragging the centre backs out of shape a little bit and maybe opening a bit of a gap for through balls for the wingers to run into.
Mm.
But yeah, I mean, it's back to the point that I was making earlier about, in a sense, that the players that are most successful at the highest levels are the ones that are prepared to be the most cynical. And I think when he really wanted to close a game down, that's when he switched to those kinds of formations. He used the 4-3-3-2 quite a lot as well, I think, with the CDM. When he wanted to keep possession and just basically kill a game off. And very effective, you know, as we all saw.
Yeah, that was, of course, what Barcelona were using to play their very, very possessive football that they, you know, they beat United with in the final a few times in the Champions League. And it is very good for keeping the ball. And in FIFA, I think it works pretty well because a lot of people, if they're playing the narrow formation, you obviously match them up in the midfield, essentially. Same.
I think that's
CDM, centre mid, centre mid.
Twice in 10 minutes that you've mentioned Manchester United, Ben. I think we should mention there are other football clubs, or you should declare an interest at this point. One or the other. Take your pick. Declare
there are no
interest,
other football clubs available. That's let's move on from football because it's not an especially good time for Manchester United. What were we going to say next, Luke? I think you wanted to say something. What was your point going to be?
Yeah, I was just gonna. I had two things I was interested in picking Fiddle's brain on since we have him. The first was MS Dosari. You were just talking about kind of what he was doing in the final. He said kind of in the post game press conference that after the grand final, after he'd won it all, that sort of his biggest concern, like the one lingering doubt he had in the back of his head the entire time as he's winning these just crazy games en route to his championship run this weekend, was his defense. He said, I always knew I was going to score enough goals, but I just didn't know if I was a good enough defender to win this tournament. Is that self-scouting kind of part of the equation when you're kind of getting through these grinds of going through great pro after great pro after great pro, or are you just sort of in this flow state where you're kind of just flying the plane, doing the best you can?
I think you get a little bit of the time after a game where you kind of self-evaluate and you always see your stats. I mean, you look at any TV, you've seen how many goals you're giving up, you see how many goals you've scored, you're like, all right, I know I need to defend. But I mean, with Dosari, I think it was his destiny that he was going to win that tournament. And he was too smart. Every player, he felt like he had the upper hand. And, I mean, if he felt he wasn't defending well, but, I mean, in those events, you're never going to see a 3-2 game on a series. It was always going to be first 1-8 goals usually was going to win. There was really very few low-scoring series.
Definitely. Sorry, this is just coming at a slightly different angle, but I wanted to bring it up because we were just talking about it. We had a question on Twitter from Stefan Carlson. You can tweet us at FootWeeklyPod. Any questions? And he says, I'd love to know if we should consider the 4-4-2 as a top tactic for us casuals, or whether it was more of a sort of pro tactic. First of all, Fiddle, as you're the pro, is it a format? I mean, you mentioned actually that you'd used it and hadn't found it best for you, but do you think it's something that people could adopt more widely, or is it something you need to be sort of a very, very excellent player to master?
My time with the 4-4-2, I realized you really got to be able to create for yourself. Like, you have a lot of width, and it helps defensively having those wide mids helping you defend. But I feel you're lacking that cam. So with lacking that cam, you really have to be able to create yourself, like take a few touches and beat someone off the dribble to make enough space without a cam. But I don't know. I think a casual standpoint, you should probably stick to like a 4-1-2-1-2 or a 4-2-3-1, something where you have a cam.
I will say, interestingly enough, I was a long-time 4-1-2-1-2, like essentially guerrilla disciple. Even when I would play with like a 4-3-2-1, I'd switch to a 4-1-2-1-2 in game. Similar tactics to him, maybe a similar kind of debonair approach as like a hashtag Harry, where I'm just like, I'm playing to get the game over with almost. It's like my language in game, my body language, or my tactical approach is just like, let's rip some goals, let's just get this done with. That's how Harry always seems to play, and it works for him until it doesn't, right? Same with me. I switched to the 4-4-2 after talking to Benedict Salazar in Barcelona, because he was telling me that he thought width in this game was a little broken, and he felt that with the 4-4-2 you could kind of get some stability if you had the right guys. Now, I'm, you know, I have what I consider like a luxury club, and I still don't have enough coins to go get like a Vieira or a Hullet. If you have those two guys, maybe a 4-4-2 would work really, really well for a casual if you're a super big spender.
I agree. I think that might be one of the key points, is having two exceptional midfielders who can kind of do almost everything, and that's not going to be that possible for most players. I don't know whether, Steve, you've got any points on that. Is it a formation you've kind of tried yourself? I know you're a fan of using width, but
yeah, it's very different to the formations, the styles that most people are used to playing, because you don't have that cam. It's useless for quick counter-attacks, because normally what you're relying on with the counter-attack is having the cam and the two strikers, the triangle, against the two centre-backs. So you're kind of relying on outnumbering 3-2. Well, the best you're ever going to get with the 4-4-2 is a 2-on-2 counter-attack, pretty much, with your two strikers, your two central strikers. It requires more patience, but it can be very effective. It's back to having the overloads in the wide areas. If you're playing somebody who's playing 4-1-2-1-2 narrow, or any narrow shape, then by playing with two banks of four, you're always going to have the right back and the right midfielder, and they're going to get 2-on-1 overloads on your opponent's left back. so it has its advantage in that sense. But if you're kind of stuck in your ways of just, you know, bang it up to the cam, play 1-2s with the striker, through ball, hope you get a goal, and do that for 90 minutes, then I wouldn't advise the 4-4-2 unless you want to broaden your horizons and try something different instead of going to play Fortnite.
I do have to quickly float this, speaking of hashtag Harry. So the broadcasters were criticizing him the whole tournament for running out Team of the Year Dani Alves, who is a player that I love him as a super sub. He's really small, so you can't really play him in a 4-4-2. But if you have like a 4-1-2-1-2, I think that he can be okay as kind of one of those left or right mids coming on at the 60th, 70th minute or whatever. If you're just trying to steal the ball, steal possession, and create some quick offense with a faster guy off the bench, even though he's undersized, I think that works. I personally, like, I hate his work rates for actual playing fullback, but hashtag Harry played him the entire tournament, and they kept criticizing him. And finally, in the console quarterfinals, he basically lost the game because of Dani Alves. Like, Alves,
what are his work rates, Luke?
I think it's high. Am I mistaken?
No, it's high attacking, low defensive.
Ooh. Okay. Well, whatever. He's dreadful for me, at least at fullback, right? I just can't. I've never been able to get...
I totally agree. And this is something, it's interesting because, Fiddle, I apologize, I'm not trying to kind of get at all pro players here, because many pros are pretty tactically astute and aware of player stats and their work rates. But you're absolutely right. Dani Alves has low defensive work rate and high attacking. And every time I've played him, I've basically been able to exploit that because he doesn't stay in his position. I think even if you put stay back on him, he just isn't as active in defending as other players because of that. So you can put him there, but he's not necessarily going to work as hard to be in the right place. Kind of strange he's done that, because you consider the other right backs that are now available in foot. Like, why would you choose Dani Alves over them? But it's an interesting one. Pros are exceptionally good at the game, and some of them are so good that the other aspects, like the selection of players and tactics, are kind of a bit of a side story for them, even though they are incredibly important. I think this is why maybe managers and things like that will become more important as time goes on.
I wanted to ask Fiddle, have you ever made like a substitution just because a player was available that you haven't used as often, and have that like really burn you at one of these tournaments?
It didn't really burn me. Mine was Maldini at this last tournament. I really liked the way he played. But other than that, I mean, I have a ultimate team that's, I have a pretty much almost every player available to me. So that doesn't really pertain to me as much. So I got a chance to use about everyone.
So before we finish up our discussion on Manchester and esports overall, and we'll move on to Team of the Season, we're going to quickly ask you to round up your thoughts on this tournament and maybe what we'd like to see. Luke, first of all, what would you like to see? And just give it maybe a rating out of 10.
Yeah, so I think, as Fiddle said, is, you know, you guys from watching at home, from me having been there as press, I think the biggest thing for me is that even being there, it's really hard to tell who's playing who and kind of what the results were recently. Whatever EA can do on their end technically, you know, whether that's an API, whether that's like a data partner, or whatever they can add to make it, you know, I'd love to have like a real-time scoreboard somewhere.
Definitely.
EA.com/scores. No, I'm just kidding. We would love to partner with them to surface something like that. And just selfishly, me as a fan, me as someone there as press in attendance, I'd love to better know what's happening, because there'd be some awesome results. And it was harder than ever, I think, to follow all the action at once, depending on where you were. So you'd focus on like a couple, the way they had this set up is you could watch kind of 3 or 4 games at the same time, but you might not know what's happening in something else. So if, you know, Taz is getting upset by Remy Martin, but you're overwatching like hashtag Aga or hashtag Boris or whatever, like you might not even know it. So having the ability to kind of look real quickly and see, okay, this score is going on, I want to go follow this instead. Or even the folks at home, you know, that might help the broadcast figure out, okay, let's shift to this game, which is much more interesting than the, you know, 2-1 snoozer that we're covering or whatever. I think that would go a long way, just kind of better letting us know what's happening in the games that they aren't showing.
Yeah, absolutely.
On a scale of 1 to 10, I'll give it a 9. I thought it was really solid. It was like an A effort.
Great, sounds good. So Fiddle, what's your score for the tournament, and what would you like to see in the next one?
I thought overall, from a player standpoint, an absolute 10. Like, it was perfect. We had everything we needed. I didn't feel like at any point, like, EA had me behind, like, where I didn't feel like I knew it was about to happen. We knew exactly when we were about to play. We knew who we were about to play, what time we were going to play, where we were playing. Everything was fine in that sense. I think the only thing they could really add is maybe, like, an option for the player, I mean, for the watchers at home, to maybe have like an option to watch 4 different games. Like, even if there's no commentators on the game or anything, but one of their favorite players is playing, maybe it'll be on like a second or third Twitch channel, like EA Sports Bravo channel or whatever it may be. I think they need to have an option to be able to watch more games other than the one that's being shown.
It'd even be cool if they had like a NFL Red Zone or like Premier League Goal Zone kind of option where you could just have the broadcasters cut around as exciting things happened instead of just focusing on. Because I think what would happen is they'd fixate on one or two matches, and then if they were both not particularly good or they were blowouts, then you're just stuck watching these not particularly good matches.
That would make a lot of sense. Cool. Steve, from a sort of sitting at home and watching it.
Yeah, pretty much agree with the other guys. Not exactly a casual observer, but as somebody who can't dedicate 7 hours to watching the entire stream, it'd be nice if you could jump into it midway through and know that within 10 minutes of watching, you're going to get some sort of reference point, you know, where you've got an idea of what stage the competition's at and why these two players are playing, what stage they're at, who's still in, who's gone out.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. You know, from my perspective as well, you kind of jump in and you don't really know quite what's going on.
Sure.
For quite some time.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you could liken it in a lot of ways to watching a golf tournament where, you know, it goes on for 7 or 8 hours. A lot of people don't watch it for the duration, but you're never more than 5 minutes away from a shot of the leaderboard, you know, so that you've got an idea of, you've got a reference point, so you know you've what the relevance is of why they're showing this player at a given stage. Or the other thing as well, I found it incredible that they'd go to games without even showing you the teams. You had no idea of what what cards players were using in the games that you were watching, much less any idea of the tactics. Maybe that's something that players aren't so keen on revealing, but the idea of showing a game without even referring often to the lineups, I found that quite amazing.
Yeah, and the other thing that, of course, I know, Steve, you would definitely be keen on, and it's because it's something we've discussed before on the podcast, is some kind of like highlights package, because I couldn't catch the weekend. There's no way I'm trawling through like 30 hours of footage to try and work out kind of what went on and get a feel for it. But if they could put out some kind of condensed highlights package afterwards, I would definitely catch up on that during the week. I think it'd be a really positive thing.
For sure, yeah. I mean, there's a reason why the big networks do have highlights shows at the end of the day. It's exactly for that reason, you know. And to me, it's a no-brainer. That should be a given that the EA are looking to do that. I'm sure it's probably something that they will address going forward. It's early days. But yeah, hopefully it won't be too long before they do that.
Cool. And how would you rate it out of 10? Because you haven't given your rating out of 10 yet.
I really enjoyed the gameplay. I thought it was really engaging. The coverage let it down, I thought. So, a stingy 6.
6?
Yeah. I thought the coverage really took away from it. I thought the games, I thought the actual content was brilliant. But, you know, the commentators did a good job. It's just that it's not having that reference point all the time and not knowing the teams. It's just, it's simple stuff. And if that was addressed, I'd go as high as a 6.5, probably.
Harsh. Generous man when he wants to be. It's obviously those beers that have just been brought in. So let's wrap things up then. I obviously didn't catch enough of it to comment, but it's been great hearing your thoughts, and it sounds like it was really good. So I'm happy for that. Let's move on to a second half where we'll talk about the team of the season. We may even briefly mention the team of the week. Join us in just a second after a quick break.
Well, that was a long first half of the podcast, so why not reward yourself by leaving us a review wherever you get your podcast? And also, if you don't already subscribe, please do, and you can do that if you're listening on Foothead through the links just below where the podcast is embedded, or just search Foot Weekly on your podcast provider of choice. Welcome back to part 2 of the podcast. Don't worry, it's a quick one. It was a quick break too. We enjoyed it. Well, at least certainly Steve did, as he's got a bucket of beers
to his right-hand side. It's definitely that kind of day here in the UK. But it's also the type of day where we need to talk about Team of the Season, because it is, I mean, from now, it's pretty much a week away, probably even closer once you're listening to this. So there is someone who we have who probably knows more than most of us about Team of the Season because his website is hosting a vote. Yes, Luke Foothead is hosting a vote for the most consistent, which is a departure from how it usually works, actually.
Yeah, historically, for those of you that are new to FIFA or aren't as familiar with the Team of the Season most consistent, as it was sometimes called, now called the Community Team of the Season, essentially the way this squad works is EA would put together a sort of either a short list or give previously their forum moderators kind of guidance on choosing a team based around the best players, domestically at their respective clubs and in their respective leagues that didn't receive informs during the season. So you'd have this squad that would often include one or two, you know, big name players from like a, you know, the likes of a Busquets or somebody like that, who's actually a nominee again this year. Maybe some players that play at positions that don't necessarily get goals and assists as often, so it's harder, you know, to get them those black and gold informs, right? Previously, they would do a bronze, silver, and a gold team, so that you'd wind up with, you know, a ton of players, like 70 plus at the end, or almost 70 plus at the end of informs. This season, they're just doing, because we've kind of gotten away from bronze and silver informs, to just a gold-rated team, and this time it's entirely fan-voted. So you won't... The problem in the past is, while many of the mods would do a really great job, you'd have one or two with really strong opinions and really strong personalities, and basically what they would do is sort of monopolize the process with their players. I remember there was like this huge battle over Benny Failhaber when he was on Sporting Kansas City, like... 10 pages of arguments over Benny Failhaber, like,
really?
Yeah, so yeah, that's, I don't know that MLS stands have even argued 10 pages on a MLS forum or blog or whatever about Benny Failhaber that hard, but regardless, this I think process will lead to a much more satisfying outcome. You know, you have the likes of Giorgio Chiellini, Merrick Hamsik, Jan Oblak, Nicolas Soule, and folks like that are going to be the ones that we see voted on and potentially making up this club. Jamie Vardy, Sebastian Giovinco. So there still will be a little bit of an MLS presence. There's kind of, I think, if there's one controversy about it, I've seen some folks angry on Twitter saying MLS has only played 6 matches. It's true, the MLS season just started, you know, in the past month. But I think the timeline that EA appears to be using is the end of the last MLS season through this one. So Giovinco hasn't had an inform this FIFA. So I think he's, you know, based on his form, he's perfectly adequate if you want to vote for him. I think we can all agree his tots would be a lot of fun to use, you know, the Atomic Ant. And then you have, like, you know, PK, Thomas Lamar, Javi Martinez, Andrew Robertson, who's having a breakout year. So there's some really, I think, interesting names. The squad, I think, should be pretty satisfying when it comes out in a week, with voting probably closing or having closed after you've listened to this. Should be pretty exciting. And then certainly we get into the league. Some people were also confused, thinking that this was the only tots, and they're like, where's Messi? Where's Ronaldo? No, this is like the appetizer, right? And then we're going to have, you know, we don't, the order is different every single year, so you can't really predict it. Sorry, traders, but we're going to have, you know, Premier League probably is the first or second. Bundesliga, who's also an EA partner. The generically named in-game Calcio A, better known as Serie A in real life, Ligue 1. And then you have like kind of a rest of the world team of the season. And I'm sure I probably omitted somebody. MLS doesn't come until the summer, since their all-star games in like August, but all the other leagues will get, you know, these really OP cards coming out in the next month. I'm most curious, though, getting into the sort of the team of the season sphere, and I can certainly address any of the players that may or may not make up the team based on what I know about them. But Fiddle, as a pro, is there anybody you personally or any of the pros that you talk with regularly has been looking forward to getting a TOTS to maybe add to your lineup in a future tournament?
I think the first TOTS coming up, I don't think there's much there, but honestly, outside back-wise, I think there could be an Alexandro could maybe get in over Marcelo into an event team. A right back, I'm not sure. Kyle Walker, if he gets one, I mean, he's almost got to be a no-brainer at that point. And then I think you could see a lot of Team of the Season Neymars used.
Yeah, because he hasn't had like that crazy card yet, has he, that some of the other players have.
Sorry, Ben. Outside back, is this an American thing? I've never heard of a fullback being referred to as an outside back in my life.
A fullback here would be like that's almost used as like a recreational soccer term.
That's the battering ram in the American football, isn't it?
when I hear fullback, yeah, I think about a big fat dude that blocks and maybe catches out of the backfield.
Outside back, I've never heard such a thing.
I mean, you know, to be fair, I have so many podcasts with Americans, I have to sort of just leave it, otherwise it becomes too much.
At least we didn't say what? At least we didn't say PK, right?
We're separated by a common language, right?
Yeah. So, I mean, one thing to note with the Team of the Season Most Consistent, or whatever they're calling it, community now, is that it actually generally tends to be fairly cheap because the players are quite unique. You'll see initially they're kind of expensive because people are desperate for that Team of the Season action, but over time they should drop quite a lot. And certainly once, you know, the next team has come out, you could see some really cheap prices on them. I know last year you could get some really, really good players for very reasonable prices, and that was quite nice. One thing which Foot Economist notes is that he thinks the market will dip significantly during that period, even though it's already started to drop. But we're so close to it. I think people haven't really kind of got on the panic selling hype. So that could happen at that time. And certainly as we move towards it, you probably still do have an opportunity to kind of sell up. Certainly when the Premier League team of the season hits, even if you don't see a massive dip overall, it's likely that actually when the team drops itself for that time, it will, you know, hit the market really hard. So just watch out for that. It's something that you should probably keep an eye on. I know, Steve, you've already sold up on my excellent advice in previous weeks. So.
Yeah, but I did double check with Jamie, and he says that it was actually good advice. So yeah, we're all good.
Here, I'm far from a trader or a market expert, and I'm definitely that idiot that just like overspends using players in his own club to do SBCs instead of like selling them and, you know, buying cheaper players. But hear me out for 1 second. For those of you that are looking for kind of bargain beasts, or maybe you're a free-to-play player or a Road to Glory type player and you want the best possible value, look for the guys in the most consistent or the community team of the season, rather, that get selected for their league tots as well. Because when they're re-released, their supply will be really, really high. So maybe like an Andrew Robertson, a Javi Martinez, Thomas Lamar, these guys that are going to get two releases of their tots, their supply will be double what anyone else's is. So they might get really cheap, like 20-30K.
Good point.
Mm. And the other thing is to note that, you know, some of these cards, consider their ratings. Some of them are very high rated, but very undesirable. So there's potential for investments for submitting into things like SBCs you can actually pick up.
If they do the same SBCs they did last year too, there's some real opportunities to get these like untradeables. You know, you're not gonna ever play Busquets in your lineup. He's just a player that's unreal in real life, but it's just a complete liability in FIFA due to his pace. Mm-hmm. But take that, you know, 88, 89, whatever he has, throw it into an icon SBC and you're good to go.
Exactly. So the team of the week this week is actually like one of those ones which isn't particularly good because of some weird position changes and various other things. But I just wanted to give a shout out to Zaha because he looks really fun. And I used his 84 rated team of the week and he was really good. The only thing is his weak foot is a bit lacking. But the other thing I wanted to say, and Luke, as someone who keeps a close watch over player overalls, what happened to Giroud?
Yeah, so I think this year, this is actually, if you've been sort of following the trends of how the player overalls get boosted and how the stats get boosted, they're actually sort of doing it a little bit more pragmatically this year, where if you get your first inform later, you're getting a boost comparable to a second or third, especially if you're a lower rated item. That doesn't mean, you know, everyone's going to go from an 86 to a 92 or whatever. It's not as algorithmic, I guess, as it was. Now it's more exponential, I guess. I don't know. I'm not a math person, so if I'm abusing terms, that's bear with me. Just pretend it's because I'm a dumb American. But
flag it, Luke. Flag it.
Yeah, you know, I think they're doing it more like as you get later in the season, the boosts kind of reflect that point in time. Because what would the point of like an 84 striker Giroud even be? You know, at this point. So
what's the point of an 87 rated Giroud? Who's going to use him? Really? I
mean, that's totally true. But we can at least pretend. So it's good for SBCs and nothing else. I packed it yesterday. I had some like reward packs that I hadn't opened since I'd been sort of, you know, at this tournament out of the country and traveling until Tuesday. And so I opened one of the rewards packs and got 87 Giroud and was like, all right, well. Never used this, but I'm actually really hyped for Gianluigi Donnarumma because I'm the one person that uses Team of the Year Bonucci. I think he's awesome, but he really, really sucks for chemistry, especially because he's not a Juventus anymore. So I've been using the man of the match, Donnarumma, and now I get an upgrade. So he's 6'5". Nice. He's really tall. I don't think he has the saves with feet trait, which everyone seems to think is the holy grail, but he plays, I mean, honestly, I have Team of the Year De Gea, and I barely notice a difference. So
save your coins and use Inform Perrin. He's much better.
Yeah, I'll have to check him out.
I'm not sure about that. I hated him.
Did you?
With a passion, actually. Yeah. Let's move on to someone I don't hate with a passion, and that's Ricardo Pereira, who is Porto right back and has a second Inform. And I just wanted to mention his stats because he's just really, really good card. And the same with a lot of fullbacks, that you can actually use them really effectively in central midfield as substitutes. I mean, this is a 50k sub, so maybe not for everyone, but if you want to use him at right back, he'll be amazing anyway. And he gets 93 aggression, 79 strength, 91 stamina, and 94 jumping with anchor. And he's got pretty much maxed out pace, and he's got in the 90s for all his defending stats. And he's really good on the ball with 88 long passing, 90 short passing, 90 crossing, 89 agility, 88 dribbling, and actually 86 composure, which is very good on a right back. And he's also got freestyle skills, four-star weak foot, high, high work rate. So he's really, really excellent. His 83 was, and I think this is going to be even better. Slim chance he might get a team of the season, which would be pretty phenomenal. But yeah, he looks really, really good. Fiddle, I don't know whether there's anyone you want to pick out in that team of the week before we move on.
Team of the week wise, nah. I with my team at this stage, no players that are really going to sneak into my team. But I mean, for someone that doesn't have as much of a team, I think the Pereira card could be decent. Other than that, I don't know. I'm not looking at much.
I don't know. I've kind of just given up asking pros because unless there's like a Ronaldo or a Messi or like somehow Maldini's in the team of the week or something, then generally they're not particularly particularly full of players that you might like to use because they of course have a lot of coins and a lot of good players. I think one of the things that's been interesting this year is prime SBCs for icons mean that pros can just submit all their like trash cards that they've been getting from monthlies
it's
and rewards and things.
I've loved it. I've had top 100 monthly every month, so like I have a ton of red cards that I just have not wanted like nothing to do with them, so being able to throw them into SBCs, it's been able to help. Like I did Roberto Carlos SBC just for the fun of it. And I was like, I think I can do this for like 100K. So why not? So it's been really nice. I mean, before you would have a bunch of red cards, you'd have like an 83 Phil Jones or something like that, just chilling on your bench. Nothing, never going to be in your team. So might as well throw them into an SBC and see what you can do.
Cool. And before we move on, because Foot Economist isn't here and I can fire shots at him without him knowing, actually he might be listening, in which case, I'm going to fire shots anyway. He's been going on about Naldo on Twitter, like literally since he came out on Wednesday. He keeps saying that he should be used at CDM or something. Have you seen his agility and balance? He has 56 agility and 40 balance.
Yeah, that can never be my team.
And he's like 6'5" with a high attacking work rate.
He looks so unbelievably slow. He looks like such a liability.
Yeah.
He'd be beat for days and weekend league.
He's one of those weird players who's like, might be fun as a novelty, maybe center back in a back five or something, but realistically, Foot Economist, get a grip, man. He's not going to do it for you.
Shot power 99, but like, what sick bastard is going to be ripping goals with Naldo?
Amazing. And two-star skills, of course, as well, which isn't helpful. But I think on that, you know, really positive note, we're probably ready to end this week's podcast. So Fiddle, thank you very much for making your debut on the podcast. It's really been greatly appreciated, and we've loved having your insights on the pro scene and anything else, apart from the team of the week, of course.
No problem. I was just chilling today, so it was a great pleasure to come on here and talk some FIFA with some people that are pretty knowledgeable about different areas about it as well.
Great, thanks. I might keep that for our business cards. Steve, thank you very much for joining us again. You can be found at Foot Tactician on Twitter, and also you're offering people some coaching sessions as well, so people should have a look at that if they can.
I am, sure, yeah. One-to-one coaching sessions, hopefully helping people get over the humps that they're on at the moment that's stopping them getting to the next level. Yeah, come check me out on Twitter, at Foot Tactician. All good. Have fun. Let me get to this bucket of beer that the missus bought in halfway through the podcast.
Well, that was the goodbye of someone speaking to have beer. Let's move on to Luke, finally. Thank you very much for joining us. And it's been very nice to have your insights.
Always a pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you, Luke. And thank you very much, listener. It's always great to have you as well. See you next week. Bye.
Sweet.
Yeah? Just wondering if there's something that we've left out slightly in terms of foot swap.
Nobody cares about
that. You're probably right. I did think about that before I brought it up. Yeah.